This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Box office top 10 this week. We have The Dark Knight at number 10. And with reference to the boat scene, which we were talking about last week.
The extraneous boat scene.
Yes. Richard says, the whole purpose of the Joker is to claim that anyone would turn out like him, given the right circumstances, and not that he is weak-willed. The boat scene is this on the large scale and fails, whilst Two-Face is the scene on the small scale. It's part of the heart of the plot. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you see, this is the problem. The problem is, I know that if you said to Chris Nolan, that scene's got to go, he'll say exactly what's just been said there, that it's the heart of it. But it isn't. I mean, just because something philosophically can be argued to be the heart of something doesn't mean that dramatically it is the heart of something. And I'll give you a kind of key example here. There are scenes in movies in which characters explain what the film is all about, and directors quite often take them out. And of course, the classic example, and I hate to bring it up so soon, but there we go.
No.
There's a scene in The Exorcist in which Damien Karras sits on the steps with Father Merrin, and Karras says, what's all this about? It makes no sense. And Merrin says, the point is that we're not the target. The little girl isn't the target. We're the target. It's everybody else in the house. It's the scene in which the author says, here's the message of the film. And Blatty wanted it in, and Friedkin said, no, it's got to come out. And for years and years, it was out. I was one of the people who actually argued for its reinstatement. But just because something works on a sort of philosophical level doesn't mean it works dramatically. And in the case of Batman, that scene dramatically doesn't work, because it is the point at which the author stands up and goes, and now here's the moral. And you know what the other thing that's wrong with it is? It's got the wrong conclusion. The conclusion in that scene is, well, deep down, we're all good. And actually, the conclusion in that scene should be that the mother of the children says, hand me the detonator now.
Yeah, but I was quite a nice bit. I was quite, made me feel quite warm-hearted.
No, but don't you, I'm seriously, don't you think there is a dramatic problem there, which is there's a mother on that boat with a kid?
Yes.
Well, I'm sorry, she'd just go, fine, hand me the detonator.
I'll
go to hell, but I'm going to save the child. I don't buy it. It's a conceit.
Maybe you
it's
just
a conceit
have a dark heart.
And it doesn't
heart.
Work.
You just have a
Pardon?
Dark heart.
No, I haven't got a dark heart. I'm just a realist. No. I mean, I don't, that scene doesn't work dramatically, and it doesn't work logically.
Anyway,
it only works on a writerly philosophical front.
Is that so? So,
yes.
The Stranger at 9.
Still haven't been. And in fact,
how much time do you need to catch up?
Well, the thing is, there's like 12 films out every week, and I'd have to miss something new to go and see that. And everyone keeps telling me that I'm not missing much.
The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas is at number 8.
Which I think is, a very brave and interesting attempt to do a very difficult subject for a younger audience. I do think Mark Herman has made a good job of it as a director. It has a very powerful and upsetting ending, as indeed it should do. I did watch an awful lot of the movie wondering which way it was going to go, because it is essentially a film about the Holocaust for younger viewers that attempts to see the Holocaust through the eyes of innocence. And I thought it was a very impressive piece of work, much to my surprise, I have to say. And you liked it too, right?
Yes, I did.
Now, so what's your reservation?
The reservations were purely around that I thought, as I mentioned last week, that I didn't find the camp believable.
No, it isn't believable. It's a fabulist tale, and as they say themselves, it's not believable in realistic terms, because actually that particular kind of camp would not exist. That is, it is something which has been dreamt up, effectively.
But I go and see anything with David Thewlis in it, and he's the main guy in this. Number 7 is Disaster Movie. Andrew on this email, dear Curly Wee and Gussie Goose, aren't Scary Movie, Disaster Movie and Epic Movie et al. The filmic equivalent of those, in inverted commas, humorous comedy parody songs by the Barren Knights from the 70s and 80s, where they took current hits and made amusing parodies of them? I think that's probably right. I think it's another Barren Knights movie.
It is. Funnily enough, I was thinking about the Barren Knights the other day.
I suspect very few of our listeners have been.
I was trying to remember what the pun they did was on the Brotherhood of Man song, Angelo. And it was running away together, and Joe. But it was brumming away because he was a motorbike rider. And I was trying to think what tortured pun they had come up with. And in fact, when I remember that it was brumming away together, Anne and Joe, I laughed, which I didn't do in the entirety of Disaster Movie. So in fact, there is an argument for saying
the Baron Knights are funnier.
Exactly. The Baron Knights could sue for being compared to Disaster Movie.
Step Brothers at six?
Again, not been there. Was away. Was in Shetland. Still haven't caught up with it.
The Duchess is at five.
You know, Keira Knightley's best performance and actually an interesting film. Obviously, the comparisons with stuff which has happened in much more recent history are absolutely to the forefront. I mean, the advertising tagline is even, there were three people in this marriage, so it's not hard to see where it's going. But I think she does really, really well. I think Ralph Fiennes is, you know, gives one of his classic cruel performances, and I think there's more depth in it and more style to it than there was to the Queen. And, you know, clearly Keira Knightley is blossoming with every film. I mean, I wasn't wrong, but the old IKEA thing doesn't work anymore.
No. Maybe you were wrong and you've just changed your mind.
No,
maybe
I wasn't.
Maybe Keira Knightley is the new Neil Young.
Well, that would be interesting. Should we get Keira Knightley to sing Old Man Look at You? Incidentally, that new Neil Young film's just come out on DVD. That CSNY Deja Vu thing. The absolutely brilliant Neil Young film in which Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young reform and go out on the road to sing songs about how rubbish George Bush is. And there's a brilliant scene when they go to, I think it's Georgia, and they get up on stage in Georgia and they sing a verse of Let's Impeach the President. And it's like someone has lobbed tear gas canisters into the crowd. The crowd just explode, and not in a good way.
The Women at four?
You just did. Oh, no, sorry, The Women. I said the Duchess. The Women, rubbish. Meg Ryan, rubbish. What happened to Meg Ryan?
I don't understand
how Meg Ryan's career went so far down the loo. Because, for a start, she was your favourite actress of all time, I believe.
I think I might have been misled by her general appearance.
It wasn't that you thought she was a good comic actress, it was just that you fancied her.
No, I thought there are a couple of films where she was absolutely tops, but...
Well, she was brilliant in When Harry Met Sally, absolutely brilliant, and she had really, really good time. Actually, I thought she wasn't bad in You Got Mail either, I thought she was quite charming.
And that French thing that she did with Kevin Kline was quite nice.
French Kiss.
That one.
Yes, that one.
That was quite good.
Ever since she did In the Cut with Jane Campion, which I thought was going to be the making of her as a sort of, you know, serious, dramatic actress, everything's gone completely wrong. And this is a remake of the George Cukor film from the 1930s, which just demonstrates, and we'll talk about this later on as well, that what used to be called women's cinema, the women's picture, has suffered terribly in recent years. And we are suffering now from an awful dearth of really good women's pictures because they just aren't, they're not being made anymore in the way they used to be.
Scott on this says, Dear Bagpuss and Professor Yaffle, this is because we've reached Rock and Roller at number three. Scott says, I'm having the odd sensation of listening instead of the usual podcast. How annoying to have travel news interrupting the flow. I loved Mark's review of Rock and Roller last week, but was disappointed to find out that Guy Ritchie had not written a film based on one of my favourite Judas Priest albums. I just read that out just because I haven't mentioned Judas Priest with enough regularity. And Jane in Nottingham, Dear Itchy and Scratchy, I heard the Good Doctor's review of Rock and Roller and thought, damn, I was really looking forward to seeing it on Saturday evening, not having had the chance to go to the flicks for some time. What to do? The Good Doctor says it's no good, and he's always right. I spent most of Saturday in NHS Direct waiting rooms with a poorly child and was pretty fed up by the end of the day, so I decided to continue with my plans to spend an evening at the cinema, and as there was nothing else I liked the look of, I handed over my hard-earned shekels for Rock and Roller.
No.
Please tell he who is normally obeyed, with regard to my cinema choices, that I did not regret it. Yes, it could be better, but I think that about almost every film I see. I wonder why they didn't develop certain characters and scenes, why the director or producer couldn't see the glaringly obvious duff bits and so on. Rock and Roller could be better, but I enjoyed it, and judging by the reaction of the people in the audience and some of the conversation I heard on the way out, so did a lot of other people. Sorry to disagree with you, Dr. K, on this one, but it's a 7 out of 10 and not a turkey, says Jane.
I just say, I think that the quote on the poster should be, Rock and Roller, if you've spent all day in an NHS waiting room, you'll enjoy it. I mean, all that's saying is, my expectations were so low, I was so desperately in need of moving pictures with synchronised sound, that anything would have worked. I mean, you know, there's so much other stuff that you could have gone to see that you would have enjoyed, you know, like, if you gave that 7 out of 10, that would have been 10 out of 10. I mean, the worst thing about Rock and Roller, well, there's many worse things about Rock and Roller, the worst thing about it is, even Guy Ritchie doesn't think it's any good. Even Guy Ritchie is on the record as saying that what he wanted to be making was films like Revolver. Bless him, poor love. But the audiences, they weren't up to it. You know, they couldn't get it. No, they didn't get the concepts of Rock and Roller, so I need to go back and do another one like the one I did before. So even Guy...
He's quite posh, actually, Guy Ritchie.
I can't, but this is... Okay, right, that's me doing him as I would do him. But the posh Guy Ritchie is, yes, well, I can't do it. I just can't do it. You do Guy Ritchie how does he go?
No, you don't do accents. That's just one of the rules.
Right, okay. I think he talks like Nigel out of Spinal Tap.
Anyway,
what's in here? No one.
Finished?
Yes.
Rock and Roller's at 3. Number 2 is Mamma Mia. Dear Bootsy and Smudge, says Simon in Preston. Sorry, Dr. Kermode, Mamma Mia wasn't so bad. It was good. It's just bad. The whiff of ham pouring off the screen was making the vegetarians in the audience throw up, and Mr. Brosnan should be shot for crimes against music. You let me down and you should be ashamed. Hours of my life I won't get back. Worse, the wife enjoyed it and expressed a desire for the DVD. Excellent. Best regards, Simon Williams.
No, I mean, I still stand by it. I enjoyed myself in Mamma Mia. And the point about this is, it's not enough, if you're a critic, just to say, oh, well, something's terrible, because actually you have to be honest about the way you responded to it. And I can't lie. I mean, I just can't lie about it. I saw Mamma Mia and at first I was in shock. At first I was genuinely in shock. But there was a moment, it was about halfway through, and I think it was the moment when Pia started to sing, you know, SOS. And I just gave in. My resistance was battered down and I just started enjoying it. And I came out of that film with a spring in my step and a song in my heart and a general, you know, love of the world and a feeling that I had for the first time in a very long time experienced a sense of something being so bad it was brilliant.
Anyway,
now, I understand that might not work for absolutely everybody, but what can I tell you? What can I tell you? The amount of people I know have now gone to see Mamma Mia and have thought exactly the same thing. It's terrible, but you know what? They kind of enjoyed themselves anyway.
And the UK's number one is Pineapple Express.
Which, according to, it's something like a Rolling Stone magazine, is the greatest stoner comedy ever made. Which either tells you something about Rolling Stone magazine, or tells you something about the stoner comedy genre, or it's just one of those stupid things that people say in order for it to be on the front cover of a magazine. I mean, it proves that the Judd Apatow stable is running out of steam, that we all saw those Cheech and Chong movies in the 1970s, but we don't need to see them all over again, that a little bit of discipline would go a long way in terms of honing those scripts. And, you know, it can't decide whether it's a comedy or an action movie or a stoner movie. It ends up being neither. It's just long and baggy and, you know, it's a bunch of blokes wandering around being stoners. And then every now and then some things get blown up.
Now,
I mean, that's not good enough.
Right, are you done?
Yes.
Okay, right. So, look, if we hasten along here, we could squeeze in a review just before the news and sport. What are we building up to, by the way?
Well, we've got Tropic Thunder is coming up, okay, which we'll do after the news, so I want to have a little bit of time for that. But shall we very quickly do The Wave?
Let's do a quick Wave before the news and sport.
Okay, so The Wave, which is this German movie, which is, it's almost like the antithesis of Sophie Scholl. It's about a high school teacher. He wants to do a class in anarchy, but that class has already been taken by somebody else. So he gets given the class in autocracy, in dictatorship. And he doesn't want to do it, but he takes on the class, and the class will say, oh, we're not interested in this. You know, we've been through all this sort of war guilt stuff in the past. None of this stuff could ever happen again. We're really not interested. And so in order to make the class interesting, he tells the class to form what is essentially a kind of proto-fascist group in which they all start wearing the same shirts, they all bond together, strength through unity, they all follow him, absolutely, they become a group, they kind of look after each other, and then things start to get sort of out of hand. And this group, over the course of a week, grows from being a little classroom project into being this weirdly emergent group of people who all look the same and think the same and become increasingly aggressive. And things, you know, take a turn for the worse. Now, the interesting thing about it is, it's based on a now fairly infamous, and I have to say also fairly disputed experiment which was conducted in California by a guy called Ron Jones in the late 1960s, in which, according to his account, there was an experiment done with a class of kids who sort of similarly fell into this, you know, finding something within a classroom setting, suddenly finding an identity, and suddenly this kind of almost proto-fascist group emerging as a result of it. It's very, very well directed by Dennis Gansel, who made Before the Fall, and it's one of those films, a 15 certificate. I think it's a really good film to show to people of about that age, you know, 15-year-olds, because it's about the way in which people can fall into the most obnoxious kind of, you know, political hectoring and fall into these kind of proto-fascist models without it even, you know, without you noticing. It's kind of, it has to some extent a similar take on something like The Experiment, or maybe, you know, you could say there's a little bit of Animal Farm in it, and the way that it takes a, you know, complicated subject and simplifies it in order for it to work for this sort of small, diluted, experimental version of larger politics. But I found it really engrossing.
Is it in German? Or is it Die
Welle? It is. It's a German movie, absolutely. Right. And so it's interesting because the original Experiment happened in California. The movie happens in Germany, which, of course, actually lends a resonance to it, which the original Experiment doesn't have. And very early on, the classroom say, look, we don't want to do this. We're all fed up of being made to feel guilty about things that we didn't do but are in the national past and can never happen again. And then what happens is during this classroom experiment, this kind of proto-fascist group emerges. And it's all about the way in which, you know, you can effectively brainwash people by being mesmerizing and by, you know, sloganeering and by getting everybody to march the same way and everybody to look the same way. But it's not hysterical. It's not ludicrous. It doesn't sort of explode into kind of into nonsense. It is all kept in a fairly confined area until the very, very last movement of the film. And I thought it was engrossing. I thought it was politically intelligent. It was very, very well acted. It was, you know, very, very well written. As I said, it does draw on an actual experiment, although the actual experiment itself is disputed. But I thought it was a fascinating subject for discussion. It was the kind of thing that, you know, you think teenagers ought to go and watch because it's really dramatically engaging and there's a really good conversation to be had about it.
So this from Stuart in Littlehampton. Dear Maloney and Hightower, whilst it's nothing new for Hollywood to plunder Asian cinema, this is an interesting tagline-y type thing.
Yeah.
You still there? Oh, you're good, okay. To plunder Asian cinema in a never-ending string of mostly second-rate remakes, like Bangkok Dangerous, even I was amazed at the depths marketing men will sink to when I saw the latest ad for a new South Korean movie called The Chaser.
Yeah, I know what you're going
to
say.
Which had the following prominent tagline.
Soon to be remade.
Can I read this email out without you interrupting? Because you cannot possibly know what I'm going to say.
No, you're going to say soon to be remade by the people who remade The Departed.
Actually, it's soon to be remade by the team that brought you The Departed. It's a sad state of affairs, continues Stuart in Littlehampton without interruption, when Asian cinema has to use the fact that its films will one day be remade by someone vaguely connected with another lesser remake of an Asian original to promote them. I just thought the Doctor would be interested in this, as it's sure to depress him slightly. Can you think of a more pointless, negative and uninformative tagline to ever disgrace a movie poster than that?
No, but I have to say that I share your feeling about that, because I was walking down the tube in Leicester Square or Tottenham Court Road somewhere in London, and I went past the poster for The Chaser. If we get time, I'll review The Chaser. And I saw that thing, which, you know, soon to be remade by the team who brought you The Departed. And I literally did that thing, stopping, you know, slack-jawed, thinking, oh, come on. You know, surely you can do better than that. It's a film which is going to be remade by the people who remade that other film that you didn't see.
Enough, you know, already.
I agree. We are of a piece with that.
Stuart in Littlehampton, thank you very much indeed. What else is new, good doctor?
Well, big one this week, Tropic Thunder, $90 million NAM movie action spoof, which I think it's taken 120 in America already, so by their sums it probably is, you know, earned its payback. Directed by and starring Ben Stiller, with a script which has in its credits Ethan Coen, so the bar is set very high. Story opens with Steve Coogan, our very own Steve Coogan, as a British director who is struggling to get the NAM movie Tropic Thunder, which is theoretically based on a true story, made. His problem is, on the one hand, he's got an abusive studio boss who thinks he's an idiot, studio boss played by Tom Cruise in odd, fat, bald, sweary mode, but still clearly Tom Cruise, and dealing with squabbling actors played by Stiller, who's playing Tug Speedman, who is effectively Zoolander as a dopey actor. Jack Black, who in his previous incarnations in this movie has starred in films like The Fatties. He's kind of like a Martin Lawrence clone. You know, it's one of those things in which he plays all the parts. And then, and most controversially, Robert Downey Jr. as an Australian Oscar winner who has undergone, in inverted commas, pigment alteration and, at least according to the trailer, Ebonics voice training. Although that line isn't in the film. I was listening for it and it isn't in the film itself. Meaning,
Ebonics?
Yeah, he's blacked up. Yeah, that's the joke. That joke is in the trailer, but it's not in the film itself. So, basically, Robert Downey Jr. playing an actor playing in blackface. All the actors are rubbish. The movie's going down the toilet. So Steve Coogan comes up with this idea. Steve Coogan's character comes up with this idea to make the movie work, which is he actually transports them off into the middle of the jungle and says, right, I'm going to leave you here and see what happens. Here's a clip.
We have rigged this entire Valley of Death with hidden cameras. And I will be shooting as well from unseen vantage points so that every glorious moment is captured on film. And believe me, gentlemen, it will be glorious. If it looks real, chances are it probably is. You wanted to be actors? You wanted to occupy the skin of another human being? Well, get ready to occupy the skin of a terrified US infantry grunt surrounded by death. There'll be ambushes, enemy fire, your own little personal slice of Nam. This radio goes to the chopper and the chopper only. The chopper is God, and I am Jesus Christ, his son. You are my chosen disciples, and no one gets to go home till we get the shots. Put on your war faces, gentlemen. Now, let's go and make the greatest war movie ever!
Yeah!
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 Aha!
Sorry, yeah, aha would be the right response, except that's the end of Steve Coogan, because that's 15 minutes in, he steps on a landmine and he doesn't exist after that. So the deal is that the characters are then lost in the jungle and have to find them, and they can't figure out whether it's a movie or whether it's real. Okay, that's it. Steve Coogan's role is just at the very beginning. Now, a few things to say. One of the things about the movie is that it raised a lot of eyebrows when it was being made, and indeed immediately after it was released, because it deliberately deals with subject matter that is, let us say, tricky. Most audaciously, the Robert Downey Jr. character. I mean, if you remember what happened when Spike Lee made Bamboozled, which was a pastiche about blackface. I mean, two people go to a television studio and they're just trying to prove how racist the television studio are. So they suggest a blackface TV show and the television studio love it and it becomes a cult. And when the movie came out, and Spike Lee's credentials, I think, you know, are fairly, you know, well documented, people was accusing Spike Lee of being racist and using racist imagery. When Robert Downey Jr. was first offered this role, he apparently was really worried about it because he wanted to make absolutely sure that everybody understood that what he was doing was, you know, satirizing anybody who would think that, you know, doing this was even vaguely respectable. And so to that effect, you've got always as his sidekick, Brannon T. Jackson, who plays this rapper called Al Pacino, rapper turned actor Al Pacino, who keeps looking at the Downey Jr. character and going, I don't know what you're doing. It's really offensive. How dare you be doing all this stuff? There's also another issue, which is that the character which Ben Stiller plays made a movie before this, you know, in the film within a film called Simple Jack, in which he plays a character who's kind of Forrest Gumpy or a little bit Rain Man-y. And let me just read you what it says about this from the BBFC website. I'm quoting here from the British Board of Film Classification website. It says, the film is spoofing politically correct ideas. One of the actors within the film is shown to have once made a film as a mentally retarded man, and several spoof scenes from this film are shown. In addition, one of the principal actors is a white man who has, in inverted commas, blacked up for the role of for the role in the film within a film. The comic absurdities of these characters are played out to the full, but could be misconstrued as offensive. So even the BBFC, in classifying the movie, were aware that what was happening. They understood the joke, but they were also aware that the joke could be mistaken. And there was a lot of stuff about this in the press. Certain groups got upset about it. Ethan Cohen said specifically that, as far as the scenes with Stiller were concerned, he said they weren't meant to derive humour from mental disability, but to satirise emotionally exploitative depictions of mental disability in movies such as Forrest Gump and Rain Man. Okay, so it's very clear, I think, exactly what the what the movie makers set out to do. It's also very clear that some people could take offence, but you'd be missing the point. That said, the biggest problem with Tropic Thunder is that with all this edgy stuff going on in it, it's nothing like as funny as it ought to be. I think all the best stuff is the stuff which is edgy, the stuff with Ben Stiller in those particular roles, the stuff with Robert Downey Jr. is this just ludicrous Antipodean actor who thinks that it's reasonable to, in inverted commas, get into character and become kind of some terrible Action Jackson parody. And he never breaks character. All the way through the movie, he is in this kind of ludicrous racial pastiche, which is completely unacceptable, and yet he can't see it. The problem is the rest of the movie's terribly baggy. Jack Black's character is just kind of there but not funny, and also not Jack Black. I don't know how well it manages to handle some of the violence. I mean, there's an awful lot of sort of on-screen, you know, violence and mucking around and action, but I don't know that that actually sits nicely alongside the comedy as well as it should do. And I just got this sense of watching it thinking, I've been really looking forward to this. It sounds really edgy. It sounds really sort of like it's, you know, it's doing something that's very, very odd for a mainstream Hollywood movie. It's cost $90 million, and yet it's not a belly laugh. There are several bits in it that are funny. There are several bits in it that are very, very baggy. And it's one of those weird films when the idea of it is much more enjoyable than the film itself. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm quite glad that they've done what they've done, but it is all over the place. And all the funniest bits, there's a bit at the very beginning in which you see the trailers of the movies that these guys have theoretically made before, and those short, pithy trailers are funnier than the rest of the film. And the scenes with Robert Downey Jr., who I used to have a real problem with, are the funniest thing in the film, but an awful lot of it is just padding. And I think the $90 million didn't help. I think if you give somebody $90 million, they just go, I think the best thing would have been if they'd said, you got $15 million, do it with that.
Sorry to try and interrupt on my program, but is baggy the opposite of taut?
It's exactly the opposite of taut, yeah. And once again, it's a classic expression of that thing that what you really needed was a producer to go through it with a chainsaw. Go, no, 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 lose Jack Black's character, that just doesn't work. Cut out the action sequence, you don't need that. Pull back on the budget, you don't need $90 million. It should have been made for a quarter of the money, and it would have been a lot edgier.
Just before we continue, Jason Isaacs, hello to you. Wherever you are.
And hello to Stephen Fry, hello to Kenneth Branagh, hello to David Morrissey, hello to all the members of Fairport Convention. Who are we missing?
And also Paul Samuel Smith, just want to say hello to him and other assorted members of the Yardbirds, because Paul wanted to be a part of the programme when we were talking to David Simon on yesterday's programme. So hello to him and other members of the Yardbirds like Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton.
And hello to Merrin Smith in the Sillies because he's called Merrin.
And there was a member of the Yardbirds called Jippy Mayo. It could have been Gippy, but it looks like Jippy.
Is that if you do a bad show? I've just had a bit of a Jippy Mayo.
Absolutely. So one of those. What else can we squeeze in?
Okay, let's quickly squeeze in two more. Then She Found Me, the directorial debut by Helen Hunt from the novel by Eleanor Lippman. Helen Hunt plays a glamorous middle-aged teacher who's married to Matthew Broderick. Very, very early on, Matthew Broderick says, I don't want to be married to you anymore. He runs off. Then her mother dies. Then she's adopted. Then she gets a call from somebody else saying, I am your real mother. Do you want to meet me? She says, oh, blimey. She goes to a restaurant. Turns out her real mother is Bette Midler. Here's a clip.
Ask me anything. You're sitting on anger. Ask me anything. Hit hard. Ask me anything you want.
Why did you give me up?
On you will go, though the weather be foul. On you will go, though your enemies prowl. Onward up many a frightening creek, though your arms may get sore and your sneakers may leak.
What?
It's a book by Dr. Seuss. Did your adoptive parents ever read it to you?
No.
Oh, that's a shame. Because it's a map of your life, really. The whole point of which is that every ending is a beginning. Now, when Trudy and Julius passed, that was an ending. But in a funny kind of a silvery lining-y way, it's brought us together, hasn't it?
I have to go.
Wait. Stop. Don't...
Number of things to say. Firstly, I'm a sucker for Bette Midler. I just think Bette Midler is great. Did you ever see that film For the Boys?
I think I've seen one Bette Midler film once.
Oh, fine. So what, you've seen, like, The Rose?
No, it wasn't that.
I tell you what, I've got a DVD of For the Boys. Let me lend it to you. It's an absolutely... It's a terrific movie with Bette Midler and James Caan as a vocal singing group who sing throughout various conflicts from World War II to Vietnam. Were very, very well made. Made by Mark Rydell, actually. Very interesting film. Anyway, look... The stuff with Bette Midler and Helen Hunt works fine because I think Bette Midler's funny, and I think the idea of discovering that your adopted mother is Bette... Obviously, she's not playing Bette Midler, but she's playing... Bette Midler only ever really plays Bette Midler. So that's all the characters she plays, so that's it. So I think that's funny. The problem is that what's happened is that the script has expanded upon the original. People are always expanding upon the original. So there are two elements that are brought in that appear to be new. One of them is that the Helen Hunt character has a sort of on-off affair with Colin Firth, who is... She's a teacher. She's teaching Colin Firth's kids. Colin Firth's partner has gone off. Colin Firth is obviously Colin Firth. He's very attractive because, you know, he's Mr. Darcy, blah, 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 blah. So she starts having a thing with him while still wondering whether or not she should be back with Matthew Broderick.
A lot of people probably would, actually, wouldn't they?
What, have a thing with Colin Firth?
Well, I reckon, you know, if that was the situation, then people would go, well, all right, then.
There was a point when he was voted something like, you know, sexiest man in Britain. But it was also, I interviewed him around that time when Trauma came out, and he said, obviously, you know, he was a serious actor and the whole, you know, sexy thing didn't matter. Although, you know, frankly, it's easy to say that when you look like Colin Firth. I mean, for me to say it doesn't matter, it's like, well, fine, but you haven't got the option, but he's Colin Firth. Anyway, look, moving swiftly on. The other thing is, there's a whole ongoing subplot about the desire to have a baby, which... These two things sit very, very uncomfortably alongside the kind of the rather broader comedy about her discovering that her adopted mum is Bette Midler. So for a start, it looks like it's two films put together. And this often happens when, you know, actors get behind the camera. They make very actorly films, but they're not very, very well directed. She cites James Brooks as her inspiration, which is not surprising because it was in As Good As It Gets that she won the Oscar for Best Actress. Although, frankly, to me, Helen Hunt will always be that girl out of Twister because I like Twister more than anybody else does, apparently. The other thing is, which is very strange, is some of the dialogue is incredibly sort of TV movie of the week, and Helen Hunt is incredibly thin. I mean, like, incredibly thin. And I was watching it with somebody just the other night, and there's a moment in it when Helen Hunt says, the thing about, she's talking about the Colin Firth character, she says, the thing about it is, he sees me. And the person next to me said, well, I'm, you know, he's the only one, because frankly, if she turns sideways, you can't see her.
Hey!
No, but it's a worry. She's a, you know, beautiful, intelligent woman. Why is, you know, what's with this incredibly thin thing?
Well, why can't she be thin? Maybe she
it's
just
not
is.
Healthy.
Well,
put weight on, for heaven's sake, eat more burgers, you know, veggie burgers, obviously. Anyway, it's one of those things when it's obviously made from the heart and it's obviously, it's an actorly piece, but it's baggy and all over the place. But the stuff with Bette Midler in it is kind of, you know, is Bette Midler. I've never seen a film in which I haven't enjoyed Bette Midler. Sorry, but there we are. And the other film I want to quickly get in the minute that's left is The Chaser, this Korean movie, which, as you know, seemed to be remade by the people who brought you the remake of Infernal Affairs, The Departed. As with all Korean movies, it's 16 films happening at once. The story is there's a pimp whose girls are apparently being kidnapped and sold, but then it turns out they're not being sold, they're being captured by a serial killer, and the pimp turns out to be a cop, and then the cops are too busy investigating somebody who threw poo at the mayor of Seoul. And I'm not making this up, this is actually the plot.
The mayor of where?
Seoul.
Oh, right, the mayor of Seoul.
The mayor of Seoul.
And threw poo at the mayor of Seoul.
Well, apparently not. Apparently throwing poo at the mayor of Seoul is considered to be bad. But that's the least of his problems because there's a serial killer on the guys. And then the police get the serial killer and then the serial killer is released because they're too busy investigating the bloke who threw the poo. And like all those movies, there are bits in it that are incredibly nasty.
That's
there are
a
bits
bad
in it
day,
that strangely knock
day.
About fun. What?
Serial killer and someone throwing poo around.
I know. And the police are more interested in the poo chasing. But it's, you know, it's like all those films. It's a little bit like Memories of Murder. It's not as good as Memories of Murder. Memories of Murder was a really, really intelligent film. But there's 58 different things going on at once. And there's this child in the middle of it. And some bits of it are sort of seen through a child's eyes. And some bits of it are grisly, leery serial killer bits. And some bits are incredibly parodic about how rubbish the police force are. And it goes on for over 2 hours. And at the end, you come out of it thinking, well, blimey, you know, as the two old women who stood in front of John Gielgud to see the hardcore version of Caligula said, as they came out of the screening in New York, well, blimey, that was $5 worth.
And the movie of the week?
The Wave.
Oh, all the way back there.
Yes.
And that's the German thing.
The German movie. Which was,
Die Welle.
And I think it's, you know, I very, very good for, I think it should,
yeah,
you know,
don't do the review
become
again.
A classroom
don't do it
tool.
Again. Don't do it again. You've already done okay. It. You don't have to do it again.
Mark, yes.
Thanks very much indeed. Splendid as ever. See you next week.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.